Well, good morning, everybody. I want to thank you for braving the frozen tundra to come here today. We're continuing now with the book that we started last week called Meditation Advice to Beginners by Bokar Rinpoche. It's what it looks like. It's out of print, but there's a PDF file available online if you look for it. And if you can't find it and you want it, you can email me at member@large@columbusktc.org and I'll send you a PDF file of it. These Bokar Rinpoche books, really all of them, if you happen to stumble across one in a used bookstore, no matter what it is, just buy it. They're all great. And they're all out of print. I'm hoping they come back. So this chapter is called More to Consider. There's always more to consider. It's a little bit chopped up into bite-sized pieces. Last week was kind of an introduction to the way he thinks about meditation, and this is more to consider. Even though it's a little chopped up, I've decided I'm going to stick with that format. So we'll have a few topics covered briefly today rather than going real long on one particular topic. The way he starts out is that he calls it the sky and the mind. And he talks about how lots and lots of people, especially nowadays with mindfulness meditation being on the cover of Time magazine and, you know, and all kinds of tabloids you can look at when you check out from the grocery store, you know, there's always something about meditation with some incredibly good-looking model sitting there, totally serene, and they'll say something to get you to buy the magazine, and sometimes people do, and even if they don't, just by looking at the picture, you know, they think, okay, I know what meditation is. And it's always been like that, actually. I started meditating when I was fairly young, like 22 years old. And I remember my father giving me a big harumph, you know, harumph. I know what meditation is. It's the applied art of doing nothing. And actually, that is true. The point that Bokar Rinpoche makes in this, one of the points he makes in this chapter, is that even when we go on vacation, unless we've trained our mind in the way of meditation and spiritual practice, we're never on vacation. It's like the old saying, no matter where you go, there you are. Because you take your own reactions to things and your own afflictions and your own habits and all of that with you no matter where you go. So you can change the external scenery, and the internal scenery is just the same. And in fact, it's a lot of hard work. That's why we suffer. Sort of what he was talking about last week. It's this constant dance we're doing no matter what, based on our mental habits and the little grooves worn into our mind streams that channel where our energies are. And then when we first come to meditation, I don't know about you, I was looking for something very powerful. I was looking for some magic bullet that was going to actually transform everything. That wasn't a good snap that fast. And in the hope of looking for that, and all the hopefulness and all that, I kind of went down a few dark alleys, blind canyons, and so on and so forth. It's not like that. We think that it's somehow magical. It's not magical. This is about engaging with the way our minds actually are, which is incredible. So when he starts with this, he's talking about, we think we know what meditation is. We think we know what our mind is. He says it's a little bit like we think we know what the sky is. That's his analogy. You ask anybody what the sky is, they point to the sky and that's the sky. But really, do we really know what the sky is? It has a color, it's blue. Do we know why it's blue? Most of us don't know why it's blue. Maybe some of us do. When we're in Montana, we call it big sky country. When we're in New York, we say we see slivers of sky in Midtown because of all the skyscrapers. We obviously don't know what the sky is because we're assigning it the location of where we are. It's kind of an egocentric experience of what this limitless, vast thing is. So meditation, from this point of view, is teaching us how to see again, or maybe see for the first time that our minds are like the sky. They're vast. They don't have boundaries like the sky of Montana, the sky of Ohio. Ohio's sky is gray. Montana's sky is clear. It's not like that. It's all the sky. It's all connected. And the whole purification process of meditation is about letting go of labels, letting go of boundaries, letting go of the need to have something to grasp. Ultimately, letting go of grasping this false sense of self that we have. So, he points all that out. He uses a couple good analogies, like the sky. There are a lot of analogies in this chapter, but we'll work with that. What came to mind when I read this opening part was Joni Mitchell's song, Both Sides Now, you know, where she says, rose and flows of angel hair and ice cream castles in the air and feathered canyons everywhere. I've looked at clouds that way. But now they only block the sun. They rain and snow on everyone. So many things I could have done, but clouds got in my way. The point is that, yeah, it's all of that. And because we prefer the feathered canyons everywhere over the clouds that are giving us rain and snow, we end up not doing the stuff that's really great in our lives. We end up chasing after the pretty sky, or what we think of as the pretty sky, and staying bundled up indoors doing nothing when the skies are not to our liking. So meditation is about seeing that it's possibly different than that, and that we have the power to change our relationship to it. That those habitual reactions don't really have anything to do with reality. They have to do with something that our ego likes or doesn't like. So that's the intro. Now, before I go any further, let's do the four-line refuge prayer together the way we usually do, in order to just calm down, and with the intention of opening up, and this, I'm speaking to myself now too, hearing and taking the Dharma in deeply, realizing that when we take refuge in the Buddha is always completely perfect and always completely here in our own minds, each of us. And the Dharma is the teaching that points that out to us again and again and again, so that ultimately we see it and live that way and enjoy life from that point of view. And the Sangha is us, everybody who lives that life together, and all the enlightened people that have gone before us that have passed this on to us and still support us in a lot of ways. So if you know this in Tibetan, I'll chant it in Tibetan, please join with me. And if you don't, just follow along in your heart, thinking that the Buddha is in your heart. And the Dharma is the teaching that flows, the energy that flows everywhere in your life. And the Sangha is all around you, supporting you all the time. Sanje Chudang Soki Chok Nam La Chang Chu Pardu Dang Ni Kyam Su Chi Hagi Jin So Gi Pe So Nam Ki Drola Penchir Sanje Drupar Sho Sanje Chudang Soki Chok Nam La Chang Chu Pardu Dag Ni Kyap Su Chi Dag Yi Jin So Yi Pe So Nam Ki Drola Pen Chir Sanje Rupar Sho Sanje Chudang So Ki Chok Nam La Jangju Pardu Dagni Kyatsu Chi Dagi Jin So Yipe So Nam Ki Drola Penchir Sanje Rupar Sho. So we're kind of stuck with my sky. Sometimes it's a sky we like, and sometimes it's a sky we don't. The issue is that we've got this idea, And it's illusion. It's not the way it really is. I was reading something online about flatlanders, people who believe that the Earth is flat, and that this idea that it's a globe and it has an atmosphere, a sky, and all that kind of stuff, the way we think of it, is all just a conspiracy. And it's been perpetrated on us by NASA and others. So everything, all the pictures and all that, they're fake, photoshopped, whatever. We sort of hold on, it's laughable, of course. We sort of hold on to our own view of reality that way all the time. We all have strong opinions about everything. It takes a lot of mental energy to maintain, to develop those and maintain them. And usually that energy is coming out of a reaction, you know? It's like we all have, particularly pain and a little trauma and some stuff that's happened to us in life that is hard. And we don't want to do that again, so we protect ourselves. And one of the ways we protect ourselves is trying to figure out, you know, how things are so that we can fit into things right, fit in appropriately, and avoid all that pain and suffering. as if there was an I, a me, in the center of the universe as an experiencer for real that lasts, that doesn't change, that has a permanent identity. What the Buddha pointed out was a couple things. First, by quieting down, by calming down, he kind of continually let go of labels that he had put on stuff. He had a label on himself that he was a prince of a kingdom, and he realized that didn't protect him from any of the things that he wanted protection from. Then he became a yogi and an ascetic, thinking that if he could accomplish that, then he would also not experience this suffering. And ultimately, as we know, as the story goes, sitting, meditating under the Bodhi tree, that whose progeny, I guess, the a tree from, you know, that is the great 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 grandchild of that original tree, in the same place, is in Bodh Gaya, India, and he was sitting there. And he woke up. And people noticed what that was like. I mean, it's noticeable when somebody wakes up, their face relaxes. It's open. When you see somebody who has meditated for a long time, usually they're not tight, they're approachable. He mentions that in this chapter. He said, there's something about people's faces. And people came to him, they, you know, in the stories, they saw the glow. It wasn't just that he had an open face, he had like, poof, lights went on. And they said, wow, are you a god? And he said, no, I'm not a god. And they said, well, are you a magician? No, I'm not a magician. They said, what are you? And he said, I'm awake. That was it. I woke up. And what he decided he wanted to do was to share with as many people as wanted to listen this idea, this new way of seeing life, new way of relating to life, that if we just get down the road and follow it, persevere in it, we can wake up too. And so that was the whole thing. He wanted to destroy, he wants to destroy pain and suffering. He wants us to understand precisely what the sky is, precisely what our minds are, precisely what meditation is. Because it's in that integration of wisdom and knowledge that freedom from suffering is born. Also, all the qualities of kindness and compassion are also born. That's why we teach kindness and compassion. If you practice that, it actually helps retrain your mind. All that defensive stuff of trying to make it how you want it, trying to relabel stuff the way you want it to be, kind of drops. And you can work with things the way they are. That doesn't mean we don't have valuable and informed opinions, but the way that we integrate them into what's going on is completely different. When it's done with a kind heart and a compassionate view, it's different. So, Bhogar Rinpoche says, well, what happens when we don't do this? He says, another analogy here, it's a little bit like being a king. You've got it all. You really do. You got not just shelter, but gorgeous shelter. Not just food, but great food. Not just family, but people devoted to you and at your beck and call, and yet you fall asleep at night and you have nightmares. You go through your life and you're still feeling like things aren't right. And he said, that's the way it is for us. We try really hard to get all our external conditions right, thinking that by doing that, we won't suffer anymore. If I could just win the lottery, oh my, pay off all my debts, not worry about raising more money for KTC, which is hard. It's hard. Kim has done a lot of hard work. All of us have. I mean, Justin and Kim were working on stuff when I got here. I mean, it's always, it's a lot of stuff. But guess what? The minds that we bring with us to that are the same as the minds we bring with us to vacation, are the same as the minds that we bring with us here. So the issue is, how do we deal with the mind? It's difficult in part because we don't know what the mind is, just like we don't know what the sky is. I'm going to read to you a paragraph because I think it's brilliant. And I think it's important, and I can't figure out how to say it better or differently, so. It's called Ego and the Five Poisons. Our mind is fundamentally infinite. I'll make some asides along the way. I don't know about you, but I don't experience my mind that way. So this is an article of faith. But he said, he apparently got it though. I think so. So our mind is fundamentally infinite. It's not limited by constraints of an individual existence. There is no ego. That blew me away when I read that. Although it does not exist, we identify ourselves with this illusory ego. It is the center and touchstone of all our relationships. Everything that confirms its existence and is favorable to it becomes an object of attachment. Everything that threatens its integrity becomes its enemy, a source of aversion. The presence of the ego itself conceals the true nature of our mind and of phenomena. It makes us unable to discriminate between the real and the illusory. In this sense, we are prisoners of mental dullness. The ego also engenders jealousy towards persons considered possible rivals in any possible area. Finally, the ego wants to be superior to others, and this is pride. I got a lot of that one, man. I just want to be such a good boy and be recognized for it. Attachment, aversion, mental dullness, jealousy, and pride are the five basic poisons produced by ego clinging. They form irrevocable obstacles to inner peace, constantly creating worries, troubles, difficulties, anguish, and suffering, not only for ourselves, but for others. It's these five mental poisons that cause us to harm ourselves and to harm others. It's important to understand that there are two parts of the brain that get involved. We talked about axons and neurons and myelin last week in conductivity. Fun. Now we're going to go to two other parts of the brain. there's the prefrontal cortex and the amygdala. The amygdala's got the fight or flight kind of thing going on. It's where our reactions are. And the prefrontal cortex is where we can consider different things and come up with creative solutions and all of that. Usually, when we're in a state of desire or in a state of aversion, we're just reactive. I mean, we chase after something we want, like I've just got to have an Oreo. Thank you very much. Or in a state of aversion, I really, really hate tax time because the IRS scares me to death. And it's so complicated, I always think I'm doing something wrong, even when I'm not. I mean, it's this big, like, crazy, fear-based thing, and it's just instant, just thinking about it. I'm going through a thing in my business. My business is highly regulated, and I've got it simple. And now I've decided to change something. Somebody wants to join it, which means that the regulators are going to look at everything again. I totally freaked out inside. Nobody could see it. When I realized that the U4 and the ADV and the this and the that and the CRD and all this stuff on national website that regulators look at was going to get changed, and they may take a hard look at me, man, all those things were firing for me. All of them. I was just like that. We're all like that. And if I would have reacted and said, nah, I'm not going to do that, I want to just keep my old life and keep it simple and everything, I probably would have been letting those clouds block the sun, as the song says, because I think this change is a good one. And rebuilding Columbus KTC, as hard as it is sometimes to do what we're doing, I think it's a good thing. So what does meditation do in the midst of all that? Well, those things that are reactions are still just activity, right? When they're just reactions, we identify them with them, like, I am scared. When you're meditating, though, and you're not moving, and you're just resting your mind on your breath or some other object of meditation, and you realize something came up, like fear, something strong. I mean, it doesn't just have to be, what's the grocery list for this afternoon? That happens too. But I mean, even the really strong stuff, you can recognize, there's fear there, and let it go. And by doing that again and again and again, it changes your relationship. It doesn't necessarily mean that everything is purified and you're never going to feel that fear again. But what it does mean is you're not going to put yourself in prison anymore, being imprisoned by your egoic reactions to things, okay? Basic shamatha practiced every day actually puts a new habit into your brain as to how to handle all this reactivity that's going on all the time, right? And then it allows, ultimately, this creative part, the prefrontal cortex, to get involved and ask some questions like, what's the nature of this? And that's the basic question. I'm not going to go too deeply into it. That's for another chapter later on. But at the point where you can ask a question and be curious, you've actually broken the cycle. It's like, there's fear there. What's that all about? And then thoughts will come up and you let them go and you return to your breath. Later on, after you've calmed down completely, you can return and say, okay, I want to know what that's all about. And there are various avenues towards gaining insight. Anything can, from talking to a Sangha member or a friend, to talking to a counselor or a psychologist or a psychiatrist, or to just, you know, contemplating it on your own. But it's a whole different thing. And then, when you come up with some insight, it's kind of like the sun breaks through all those clouds. It's like, aha, now I see it. Now I see what I can do. So the important thing about this is that we practice a little bit every day so that our minds can get used to working this way, because that's not how we're hardwired. We're not hardwired to do that. But we can be wired to do that. And that's what the Buddha's teaching is. He's saying, let me help you destroy suffering by changing this relationship in terms of what's firing in your mind, no matter what it is. It can also be desire. A lot of addiction. I have a lot of clients and friends who are in AA, and they've been very, very generous with me, sharing with me. And some of what they've told me is a couple interesting things. That the beginning of addiction is always some form of running away and finding an effective way to make the pain stop. And if it feels really good, like some drug-induced rush or something, you know, then it's a real strong binary thing that develops into a real problem. That's why last week we talked about leaning into the pain a little bit instead of recoiling from it. Lean in so that you realize that this is a part of life. And you can forgive yourself for what you're feeling. You can forgive life for throwing that stuff at you. And for suffering and forgiveness cannot coexist in the same place. They cannot. So forgiveness is a real key when you're encountering difficulty. Even if you don't know what you're forgiving yourself or others for, just think about, I want to forgive. Just the desire to. And it'll give you a little space. This can come up in meditation, because things come up in meditation. When I teach meditation, I've heard people say, I sit down and my mind seems noisier than it was before. I'm just flooded with all this crap. Well, that's actually not true. You're not noisier than you were before. You just notice it now. So lean into it. Forgive yourself for that. And let go of whatever that stream is and just come back. That's the whole practice. I wrote some notes here. I don't know if they're worth talking about. I think I talked about it. So what happens when we just react? That's the important other thing you have to understand. What happens when we don't react? Actually, the same thing happens in the sense that we're creating what we call karma. Karma is, there are a lot of definitions, and there's a long scholarly thing here, but I want to reduce it. Karma is what our mental habits are. It's, we kind of, as we repeat actions, we create what we said last week, just more conductivity in certain circumstances. So we're more likely for reacting to situations like I mentioned before in fear. And what meditation does is it creates something else. It creates a different karmic potential. So we have the power to do that. We have the power to do that. And if we don't do that, we have the power to create karma too, and we're going to create more of the same. Sorry, I know that doesn't sound like really good news, but that is what the Buddha taught. And so we have to understand that what we think, what we do, and what we say is really important, because every thought, word, and deed actually creates another imprint. And you can think of them as imprints. You know, it's like if you watch rainfall in a creek bed, and that creek bed's old enough that there are like grooves worn in rocks, that rain goes down the grooves into the creek, right? And it doesn't stay on top of the rocks. Our mind streams are like that too. So as we think, do, and say things, which is what's happening all the time, we're wearing a groove in that rock, and that's where our life energy is going to flow. So when we meditate, we're wearing a groove of letting go and at least aspiring to insight. We're wearing a groove of kindness and compassion to ourselves and others. That's why it's so important to practice properly. When we say that you don't just plop down on the cushion and expect magical things to happen, you begin with the aspiration that your practice will be for the benefit of all beings, including yourself, maybe especially yourself. Then you practice properly. The instructions are simple. And then at the end, you dedicate the merit. Why? Because at the beginning, you're wearing yourself into an altruistic groove, and it will change you over time. And at the end, you're wearing your mind stream into a generous groove. And generosity will build over time. It'll become so natural to you where maybe it wasn't before. A lot of people hold back a lot, thinking, I can't do that, I can't do this, so on and so forth. Well, meditation, if done properly, actually begins to open you up to what these really perfect ways of living are, the first of which is generosity. And it builds good karma. There's cause and effect that goes on. So when you're generous, actually, things are going to happen that are remarkable. You may have more opportunities for generosity. You may see more harder stuff. That doesn't mean you're generous so you'll be rich. I'm not saying that. But you'll start seeing more and more opportunities in life. And oddly enough, as we start to practice on the cushion like that, and then off the cushion kind of responding to life with generosity, ethics, patience, joy, meditation, and wisdom, at the end of the day, we're happier people. There, like I said, there's no room for suffering anymore. And that's the object of the exercise, really, for the Buddha's teaching. I heard something on NPR. It was one of the producers of one of the shows shared a letter to Santa that one of her kids had written, and it was a class assignment to write a letter to Santa Claus. And the kid wrote this: Dear Santa, I am just writing this for the class. I know your naughty list is empty. I know your good list is empty. I know your life is empty. It's like a 9-year-old or something like that. Crazy, right? The point is, this isn't about a Santa Claus mentality of, you know, I'm going to be good all year, so I get a Tonka toy or something like that. It's not like that. It's good begets good. Opportunities for generosity abound, you start to see your life broader. So say something hard happens, say you get sick. What good karma, say you're in Columbus, it's really one of us, to have the hospital system we have. That's also part of karma. It's not just the sickness. What good karma to have the kind of docs we have around here and the medicines available and the friends in the Sangha that are supportive. It's incredible. And this is an opportunity to appreciate even sickness with gratitude. It's also an opportunity for your the members of the Sangha to practice generosity. In my experience, it's actually not easy to have that kind of big view unless I kind of loosen up my ego trip. Bokar Rinpoche says that it's not that this disappears, this ego trip thing, but it weakens. It doesn't. It's softer. It doesn't have quite the same kind of grip on us that it would usually have. And when that grip weakens, we can see the picture. It's as the sky is being more than just the sky in Columbus. You can see that the sky is vast and limitless. And we can see many connections that we don't normally see. Bokar Rinpoche said something. He's really like crazy in a good way. He says, contemporary science has developed extremely powerful weapons, bombs, that can kill hundreds of thousands of people. However, no bomb can annihilate the ego and the five poisons. In this domain, the true atomic bomb is meditation. Meditation is the bomb, man. That's it. I could just see him doing that. So it's all meditation is also the mind's vacation. We all work hard. We all have we get tired, and it's important that we get rest. When we go away, if our mind's still filled with all these reactions and 10,000 things to worry about, maybe our bodies get rest. Maybe we get a change of scenery, but we don't really rest. It's really important to rest, and we can have a little 10-minute vacation every day. And that's a good thing. That's a really good thing. He said a beginner should retire to a calm place, adopt a specific posture, remain silent, and respect certain conditions. In other words, practice properly. Through habit and experience, however, one becomes able to meditate in all circumstances while walking, working, talking, eating, and so on. At that point, you have a lot of time for meditation. I want to caution you, though, you can't get there from here. This isn't magical. This is just time on the cushion. So he goes on to say, you know, you can experience this freedom. We value freedom a lot. There's a lot of talk about freedom these days. And we can legally pursue all kinds of external freedom. But the only way to have internal freedom is to do this. It's the only way we know of. He makes the point that you don't want to necessarily just go and go and go and make this into a kind of an obsession. He said if you meditate 10 minutes a day, at the end of a month, you've meditated for 5 hours. At the end of a year, you've put in 60 hours. This is going to change you. It will definitely do it. If you can do more and you want to do more, fine. It's important, though, to decide what you're going to do and do it. I like to tell people, if you say you're going to meditate for 10 minutes, meditate for 10 minutes. If it's going really badly and you want to run away, don't. Stay for 10 minutes. If it's going really well and you want to make it a half an hour, don't. 10 minutes. Because it's all about those attractions and aversions. We're letting go of what we think of as good or bad. And that way, developing equanimity, peace. So if you say 10 minutes, do 10 minutes. Then if you want to do some more, take a break, have a drink of water, cup of tea, go back, do another 10 minutes. Fine. But stick with that. Get your ego trip out of it, and it'll go well. Trungpa Rinpoche used to say, enlightenment is ego's ultimate disappointment. I like that, because the truth is, the nature of enlightenment is that illusion is, ego is pointed out to be an illusion, and you get it experientially. It just vanishes. He also makes the point, which is important, and I know I've said this already, meditation's already present in us in a perfect way. It's just covered up. So what we're doing as practice is just uncovering it so we can experience it directly for ourselves. That's the key. This isn't conceptual. This is something that we've got to do for ourselves. No guru, no matter how powerful, can dump it into your head for you. In fact, it's already there. There'd be no point. He says it's a little bit like having a very fancy car, maybe a Bugatti, sitting in your garage, but you don't know how to drive. So you go get some instructions and get a driver's license so that you can drive your car. So you get an instructor, you learn the rules of the road. At first, when you're driving, you're nervous, you can't talk to anybody, you don't want any radio on, you don't want nothing. You're just... as you get used to it, now you're going to be able to talk to somebody next to you in the car. And your driving will be fine. In fact, it'll be just as good as when you're... So at the beginning, though, we meditate in a quiet space without distractions. Ultimately, though, we can meditate while we're doing anything. It's important to persevere for that reason. By persevering, we develop those qualities so that our whole life can be infused with this. He points out that if you plant a seed and you care for it really well, and you water it, keep it warm with hay or whatever, and eventually a little sprout comes up and you are expecting a gorgeous flower because you planted a seed of a gorgeous flower. You're very disappointed in the sprout, so you rip it up and you plant another seed, figuring it was a mistake. And we do this again and again and again when we're disappointed with our meditation. Plant the seed. If it says that it's going to be a beautiful flower seed, ultimately, you know, seeds are what they are, and they will eventually become what the DNA says it will become. But you have to be patient and continue watering it and continue providing it warmth and good soil nutrients and all that in order for it to ultimately blossom. Meditation's like that. Don't just start and get tired of it after a while and quit and go find another method. It'll be the same thing because our mental habits are in control. It's funny. Those things happen again and again. It's a little like people, I don't want to step on any toes, but there's sometimes, I know this one person, he's been married a bunch of times, and every single time he marries the same kind of person and their relationship ends in the same kind of way. It's horrible. The point is that our practice is like that too. We have to grow and nurture it in growing ways in order for it to be a great practice. I think I should stop here. Ultimately, I can't tell you what meditation is, and neither can even Bokar Rinpoche. It's a little like telling somebody who's never tasted chocolate what chocolate tastes like. I could tell you it's sweet and you'll really love it and you should try it and all of that stuff, but there's no way to even get close. And yet, if I put a piece of chocolate in your hand and you taste it, you'll know immediately exactly, precisely what it is. So for us, it's the important thing is to give yourself a chance to have a direct experience for yourself. The value of the Sangha, particularly the enlightened Sangha, like Bokar Rinpoche, like Kenpo Kartha Rinpoche, like Karmapa, is you get around these people and you can get a glimpse of what it's like for them. And it's mind-blowingly great. And ultimately, we'll get a taste of that for ourselves if we just keep going. So, thank you all for your attention. We have a few minutes left for questions, if anybody has any. I'd be happy to answer them. Is it for a reasonable price? Okay. Well, if you want to buy it off Amazon used, that's fine too. But yeah, I saw a couple copies that were just marked up a lot. Yeah, and I just thank you. Yes. Oh, yeah.
And I did it last year with Daryl, and we scheduled a meditation workshop in December, and it was always really this time of the year.
Wow. Yeah, so look on our website for details. Any other questions, comments? Well, let's take a moment and dedicate the merit of this practice. For the benefit of all beings that that mental prisons for all beings would dissolve and true freedom would come for everyone without exception. Thank you.